Good afternoon, everyone. I will bring to order the House Higher Education Finance and Policy Committee hearing. We are not quite at quorum yet. We've got some folks on their way. So we are going to move ahead in the agenda instead of approving the minutes. We are going to turn it over to Lutheran Social Services, who is here to tell us about the loan counseling program that they've been doing. And I believe in the spreadsheet it is $200,000 and $200,000, so a total of $400,000 in the previous biennium. With that, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and continue with your slide presentation.
Alexis Oberdorfer. Good afternoon, Chair Rarick and members of the committee. My name is Alexis Oberdorfer. I serve as the Senior Vice President for Lutheran Social Service of Minnesota. Thank you for having us today and letting us share about Lutheran Social Service and our student loan repayment counseling. Lutheran Social Service has been delivering services for 160 years.
Ms. Oberdorfer, can you actually pull the mic towards you?
I will.
If you can get it, there you go.
How about that? Is that better? Perfect.
Thank you. Please continue.
We serve 91,000 individuals and families, which is about 1 in 63 Minnesotans. And we serve in all 87 counties. LSS provides comprehensive and innovative services to support people with disabilities, children, youth, and families, and older adults across 23 different lines of service. The majority of the services we provide are in Greater Minnesota. LSS maintains memberships in a myriad of independent accrediting and oversight agencies. We routinely pass performance audits with distinction. The oversight assesses our implementation of best practice standards, which results in quality services and better outcomes for people we serve. The assessment also reviews our governance, our policies and procedures, and reflects our organization's capacity and continuous improvement. We have a long history of clean and independent financial and federal compliance audits. We have invested in many internal controls, compliance audits, and a compliance department. We have a highly regulated by our funding agencies through regular site visits that focus on our careful management and our high quality of services. Internally, we have a quarterly review process that we track the number of people we serve, client satisfaction and stakeholder surveys, and financial performance. LSS is very cost conscious, and we have a low administrative rate of 8% that we're able to do due to the scale across all 87 counties. I will introduce my colleague, Becky Packer-Neenan, to address our financial counseling and our student loan repayment services.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and continue with the slide presentation.
Becky Packer-Neenan. Good afternoon, Chair Rarick and committee members. My name is Becky Packer-Neenan, and I'm the Senior Director of Financial and Employment Services at LSS. LSS Financial Counseling has been around for over 35 years with the mission of helping individuals overcome debt, build assets, and achieve financial wellness. We serve over 10,000 families a year, either in person, over the phone, or virtually. We offer budget and debt counseling, student loan debt counseling, credit report reviews, foreclosure prevention, home buyer counseling, and financial education. We have 22 certified financial counselors located throughout the state in 9 locations, and 8 of those are student loan certified. In 2024, we counseled 1,104 borrowers in Minnesota in 58 counties. Of those borrowers, 126 were in person, 468 were through Teams or video chats, and 510 were over the phone. A typical borrower looking for assistance from our student loan counselors is someone like Jack. He's overwhelmed and doesn't know exactly how much he owes, nor to whom. One of our experienced certified student loan counselors assisted Jack in gathering loan details and balances, along with creating a realistic budget. That way, the counselor and borrower can work together to determine the best or most affordable repayment plan based on his financial situation and goals in order for him to be successful in his student loan repayment. Not all are like Jack, though. Some borrowers reach out for help because they want to retire, but they co-signed on their child or adult child student loans and are still paying on those loans, making retirement unaffordable. We also see first-generation college students who, for a variety of reasons, had to drop out of college. Due to insufficient income and or increased expenses, these borrowers defaulted and are unsure how to catch up. However, they are required to bring their loans in current and in good standing to continue schooling. We are here to help them with that process. Now on to the history of our grant. In 2012, LSS Financial Counseling piloted a project with the University of Missouri providing student loan repayment counseling at several Minnesota colleges. Based on the outcomes achieved, in May of 2015, the Minnesota State Legislature created a two-year pilot to serve Minnesotans struggling with student loan repayments. LSS was selected through a competitive RFP process with the Minnesota Office of Higher Education, where we contacted delinquent borrowers and were reimbursed if we counseled them. From October of 2015 to June of 2017, we served 1,673 borrowers from 73 counties in Minnesota. The demand proved the need for a larger scale program, which was perfect for LSS counseling as we're statewide and have the capacity to serve borrowers that need assistance. LSS testified in 2017 and again in 2018, and legislation was created in 2019 thanks to bipartisan support. LSS applied through RFP and received funding for $400,000, $388,000 of which LSS received for the 2 years of funding. We served 1,293 Minnesota residents during that time. LSS applied in 2021 and received $388,000 and served 1,713 borrowers with a total of 2,554 appointments. For this current round of funding, as I stated on the previous slide, we have counseled 1,104 borrowers in 2024. We continue to see a high demand for these services. In the first year of this round of funding, we were at 32% above the target grant targets for the numbers served. 775,700 Minnesotans have student loan debt, so the need is out there. We are successful at getting this grant because we have certified student loan and credit counselors and physical locations throughout the state offering this counseling. Our counselors also stay on top of any student loan repayment changes that arise in order to provide the highest quality counseling and accurate information. After meeting with a student loan repayment counselor, borrowers have a better understanding of their student loans, including who they owe and what their loan balances are, along with how to address them. Counselors explain that borrowers have the option to avoid defaulting on their loans, which helps borrowers ensure they don't get their wages garnished and they're able to work towards achieving their financial goals. After meeting with the counselor, 93% report increased knowledge and they feel confident regarding their repayment options. 95% avoid default for at least 1 year after receiving counseling and feel confident on their ability to repay their debt. 58% report payments are more affordable 1 year after receiving counseling, and 97% develop a realistic budget. Here's a breakdown of our student loan repayment counseling expenses so far year to date. Salary and benefits cover 2.25 FTE across 8 staff throughout the state. It's 3 staff computers, 30% of our overall phone bill. It is for pulling credit reports for our clients, staff student loan certification, money to go towards our Facebook marketing and printing our panel cards for outreach, and then our 5% admin costs that we charge to OHE to provide the grant. In conclusion, we are grateful for the opportunity to provide the work that has such a positive impact on so many Minnesotans. Thank you for allowing us to share the work with the committee.
Thank you for your testimony. I'll start with member questions. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just thank you for your presentation. And I just wanted to take the opportunity, if it's okay for me to do this, Madam Chair, to introduce the students in the room, all back there. They're all from Rochester Beacon Academy, which is a charter school in Rochester. And they are 11th grade through 13th grade. I think they have a transition program as well. And I just wanted to take the opportunity to say that what we're listening to here is about helping students who have loan debt get, because loans, college loans and stuff gets really complicated and really scary sometimes. And if you don't know what you're doing, this is an example of where you can go to get help to figure out how to pay and how to understand your loans and make sure you're not paying what you don't owe and find out a way to help pay back what you do owe. So this, even though I know it's a little sometimes complicated to come in and listen to a presentation, this is one that probably pertains to all of you if you're going to go on to any kind of higher education. So thank you for indulging me, Madam Chair.
Representative Liebling, I knew they were in the room, and I was hoping that you would actually point them out because they're from Rochester. So I'm glad you did. And for those, I don't know if the public can see the full room, but it is very full in here, and there are lots of young folks here that are learning about the process. So thank you for pointing them out. Any other member questions at this point? Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Chair Liebling, for sharing with us who the students are. We had a group of students in taxes today, and the big question was, who is your representative and what is your mascot? So can we ask these students if they know? Yeah?
Our mascot?
Yeah, for your school.
It's a shark or a lighthouse. I'm not sure
which one. So from...
It's either a shark or a lighthouse.
Awesome. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Robbins. For the members of the public who maybe couldn't hear that, they have either a shark or a lighthouse. They're not sure which. So they're there biting people or bringing light. I'm not sure which.
I have a question.
Oh, Representative Robbins, back to you.
Thank you. So I do have a question for our testifiers. Thank you for being here, and thank you for your work. So I was interested in the slide about the RFP back in 2015. I did not serve here then. So do you know, were there other applicants, and do you still go through an RFP, and are there other applicants?
Thank you.
Yes, Representative. We do go through a competitive RFP process. In the statute, it requires you must be a certified counseling agency, and you must have physical locations throughout the state in the statute, and currently there's only one other agency that we're aware of that has physical locations, and they only have about two or three counselors. So they don't really have the capacity. So there's not really a lot of options out there that can provide the service at this time. So we are the only ones at this time that have the capacity to provide the volume.
Thank you, Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for that. That's what I had heard. And I understand that the way the statute is set up, it sort of crowds out anyone else who might locally be able to provide it in different parts of the state but not have a presence statewide. But I think that's something we as a committee should look at, because I know there are lots of locally available financial counseling services that maybe could compete if it weren't for that requirement in statute. So I think that's something we should consider. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Robbins. Representative Cleburne, I thought I saw movement over here. Representative Cleburne.
Thank you, and thank you, Madam Chair, for letting us have this presentation today. I just want to thank you for the great work that you are doing, and it's really important. I mean, I would like to see this financial counseling available prior to debt as opposed to only after you're in debt. I think so much of what's happening with student loans today is really not understanding how money works, and then the capitalization of interest that harms our students, and that they don't understand that that's happening. So when they go in default, if there's a penalty or accruing interest, it becomes part of the capital debt. So it's really very harmful. And I don't know of any other type of loan where that occurs, but we know it's prevalent in student loan debt. So I want to thank you for that. To my colleague's question, and I just maybe want to expand upon that a little bit. In looking at how much you are receiving to do this service, right, while we may have, there's no hidden agenda here, I just don't know the answer to it. If, in looking at the numbers that are served, right, in order to make this doable for you in greater Minnesota, because you have those physical facilities in greater Minnesota, if you lost the ability to do this in the metro area, right, would it still be worth the time? Worth is a bad word to use. Would it still be viable for you to do this in the rest of the state if other competitors were doing it in the metro area, for example? in the seven county metro. Does that make sense?
To the testifier.
Yes, Representative, let me clarify that. We provide it statewide.
No.
So we don't just hone in on one particular area.
Right.
And in the metro, there is only one other credit counseling agency with two staff in it. So there's not a lot of competitors for credit counseling. So even if we split that with them, I'm not sure what kind of commit. I'm not sure there's plenty of capacity even if we share the grant. We can't keep up with the demand as it is. And so we could definitely serve statewide, outstate, no problem. The demand is there. The need is there.
Right. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted that clarification because sometimes if you divide a program, it's harmful. And I just wanted to make sure if we divided the program, if we're looking at reviewing statute, then we also do no harm. That's what the point of the question. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Representative Cleavorn. Any other member questions at this point? Okay, thank you. Representative Coulter down there.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just really wanted to quickly say, for those of us who are familiar with, grew up in the Lutheran Church, obviously Lutheran Social Services is a known and established and extremely valued organization. And I just, I was doing the math and, for the funding that you receive, 1,700 residents served in 21 through 23. That comes out to just over $200 a person, which is a pretty good deal given the kind of counseling and advice that they're going to be getting. And I also really wanted to just echo what Representative Cleavorn said about how, when I was getting ready to go to college, and I'm fortunate I didn't have to take out any student loans, but for folks of my generation and thereabouts, they were handing out loans like candy. And it was just all too easy for folks to get locked into loans that they had no idea how they were going to pay those back. It's hard enough to explain compound interest to 17-year-olds in math class, right? And so I think, obviously we would all prefer to get in on sort of the front end on this. But this really is a needed service for a lot of folks my age who are still paying off student loans even. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Coulter. So I also will point out that just like all the other nonprofits that came before us, we have their 90s audited financial reports and another compilation of how much comes from government grants in your packets. Online, there are 3 years worth of 990s and 3 years worth of audited financials also. And I would just, in lieu of that, or in light of that, I would just point to the audited financials on page 6. And when I looked at the total amount of government grants, government fees and grants that you receive, it says $222.9 million, which is 87% of the total revenue. I will just point that out. So 87% of your revenue comes from government grants currently. The other thing I would point out is on the 990, page 8, and it has the highest paid folks, so it's your president and senior vice president and so on, and at my count, 2, 3, 4, there are 10 people paid more than the governor and the top person being paid $420,000 after all of the extra expenses are counted in. So that all in, $420,000, 10 being paid more than the governor. The reason I point that out is because 87% of your funds come from government sources, and so I've served about a decade on the Subcommittee Employee Relations, which reviews all the state employee contracts, and it also reviews any kind of waivers. So any local government, doesn't matter who you are, if you want to pay more than the governor, you actually have to come before the legislature to get a waiver to pay anybody more than the governor. It's something that we've been talking about the whole time that we've been having hearings. And so I just want to point out on those documents that 10 of your employees do make more than the governor, and you get 87% of your funds according to your audited financials of 2024 from government sources. So I just wanted that on the record because we do have all those documents in front of us, and I believe Representative Cleavorn has a question.
Madam Chair, I think I want to be very respectful of what you just said, but when you think about the work that Lutheran Social Services does, and how much of the work that they do for older Americans who Lutheran Social Services receives those grants through a whole host of really important work. And I believe you were probably one of the largest care providers in our state for people, for older Americans and people living with disabilities, and that this money that you're receiving is not like, I mean, many of the services that you provide are actually not, you're not making money, I will say that. Would you like, since your 990 has been opened up this way, would you like to maybe expand a little bit about the work that you do for older Americans and individuals living with disabilities, please?
So which one would like to, okay. To the
Chair Rurick and Representative, thank you for raising that. It is true, we get a large amount of our funding through government grants and other sources. The largest portion of what we receive is through client direct waivers. So clients and consumers choose us as their provider for many of our disability services that we offer. And as you can see, 70% of what we provide in our annual report that I believe is also included and was handed out here today, one of the last pages, there's a pie chart that I would like you to reference that shows that 70% of our disability services make up 70% of what we do at $155 million, then followed by our children, youth, and family services, and followed by our older adult services. I believe if you look at the amount of government dollars that we receive, you will see that it's also accounted for in the equivalent expenses that go along with that.
Thank you. Yeah, this is just something that we're doing with every single nonprofit that comes before us, and we look at their 990s, their audited financials, and we do a calculation on how much government grants you're relying on, and then the salaries and a few other things. So just trying to do the due diligence. We actually have to move on or we won't get to hear OHE. It has to be really short because we're already over time to try to get OHE up here to talk about the state grant program, which is in big trouble.
That's fine. I just want to, thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to make sure that the people who might be listening or the people who are sitting at this table understand that those dollars are very much allocated for very specific purposes. These are not flexible dollars. You have no discretion on how this money is being spent. And so if you take that grant, it's dedicated. Is that correct, please?
To the testifier.
Chair and Representative, that is absolutely correct. The dollars that we take in by department has very specific oversight, make sure that we spend it in that way. And in my testimony again, our overhead for our organization is 8%. There are very few organizations that can perform at that level.
Thank you. Okay, we absolutely need to move on because we are over time. So I need to thank you and let you go, and we're going to bring up OHE.
Thank you so much.
And while OHE is coming up, we now have a quorum, and so I will entertain a motion to approve the minutes from March 11th.
Chair, I'd make the motion.
Okay, so moved by Representative Allen. So Representative Allen moves the minutes, approval of the minutes from March 11th. Any discussion about the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Minutes are approved. Okay, and now we have, they're getting set up. OHE is coming up. Welcome to the committee. Welcome back to the committee. Please state your name for the record and start your slide presentation.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dan Solomon. I'm the manager of the Minnesota Dual Training Pipeline Program at Department of Labor and Industry, and we appreciate the opportunity to share about our program. I'll let Megan just briefly introduce herself, too.
Thank you, Chair and Committee. Megan Fitzgibbon, the Manager of Grants and Workforce Initiatives at the Office of Higher Ed, and I oversee the dual training grant, which is a complement to the DLI pipeline program.
Thank you. Mr. Solomon.
Thank you. So just very briefly, for as a refresher for those of you, you know, what is Minnesota Dual Training Pipeline? It's a source of support to employers to develop their own employment-based dual training programs. So you're combining some on-the-job training paired with some formal related technical instruction. The legislature has had us work with seven industries, and so they are advanced manufacturing, agriculture, childcare, healthcare services, information technology, the legal cannabis industry, and transportation. We have kind of a running joke, but it's the truth. It wouldn't be a government program if Pipeline wasn't also an acronym, and it stands for Private Investment, Public Education, Labor, and Industry Experience. And so, you know, you're really combining all of those things together to hopefully help our businesses in our state. And so when we're talking about that employment-based training, really what we're getting at is it happens in one of two ways for the employers that we work with. Either they've got someone maybe in a lower skilled position who shows an interest and an aptitude to move up if they were just given some additional training and support, or they use it as a recruiting tool to say, hey, come work for me. You're going to earn a paycheck right away. We'll start you at this slightly lower level, but as you advance in your training, this is how you can advance in your career. But the important piece is that the trainees are on the payroll, so they're earning a paycheck. And then the dual training is, as you can see on this slide, you're combining some structured on-the-job training paired with some formal related instruction. Most often, historically for this program, that's been at a community college, but it absolutely does not have to be. For some of our occupations, it could be a bachelor's degree, it could be a master's degree, it could be from, you know, a private college, or it could be on the non-credit side of the house, for example, an American Welding Society certification. So those are just some of the kind of examples of the education paired with that structured on-the-job training. My team, we go about our work in kind of three big buckets. We host industry forums throughout the year, at least three times throughout the year, to really hear from experts in the industry, you know, what are the needs, what are the challenges when it comes to workforce, how can this earn and learn approach hopefully be of assistance. We convene competency councils, which sounds way more formal than it actually is, but the idea is when we add a new occupation to determine what are those core competencies to be successful in a job, we want to make sure that we're vetting that with experts. And so we consult with people from industry, we consult with higher ed, we consult with a whole bunch of different folks to really tell us, did we capture the job right? Did we map out the competencies for this occupation correctly? And so we do those meetings to really validate that process. Like, did we get the job right or not? And then based on that input, we make those things final. And then lastly, my team does dual training consulting, which is to say that we will meet with employers all across the state to help them think through how do you set up an earn and learn model, what are some best practices we've learned over the years. We create some tools that are available on our website. We help them with the dual training grant and that's that sort of thing as well. Very briefly, just some highlights from the year. We are now up to 104 occupations that are eligible for dual training pipeline across our seven industries. We added 10 this year, so a couple in cannabis, a couple in transportation. We added a few in healthcare, more around mental health, hearing that there was more of a need for some like healthcare social worker, an LPCC, an LMFT, and some of those kind of positions. So those were added this year. We assisted 279 employers through consulting activities. So, you know, that's us meeting with employers or them attending one of our events or our industry forums, that kind of thing throughout the year. We did 15 industry forums throughout the year for the individual industries. And then in the summer, we bring everybody together for an all industry forum. And then we also like to get out and do workforce community conversations. And so in the fall, we held eight of those around the state. Oftentimes, we paired with a local area chamber of commerce to host those meetings and invite area businesses to join for us to really learn what are your needs, what are your challenges, all of that sort of information, and then for us to also be able to share how do you do an earn and learn kind of model. And so with that, that's my presentation. I'll turn it over to Megan so she can share about OHE's piece of this.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. The dual training grant, which as you heard, is a complement to the DLI pipeline program at DLI, provides grants to employers to support and pay for the related instruction component of the dual training program they might be offering for their employees, as well as a small portion for trainee supports. We do have an appropriation in the 2023 legislative session. We did get a significant one-time increase for fiscal year 24, and then some continued one-time increase funding for fiscal year 25. Our base funding returns back to a base funding that's lower than that starting this year. And then we also have an additional appropriation that came in from the cannabis management office of $1 million each year to do grants specifically for the legal cannabis industry employers. Grant funds, like I said, can be used for tuition fees, required recommended books, supplies, materials, as well as up to 10% can be used for trainee supports, which falls into a number of different categories. We have the seven industries, and our most recent report was issued just a few weeks ago and talks a little bit about how we have grants that are in all of the industries. In our last round, we currently have an open RFP, so we have a new round coming out this spring, but in our last round that went out in 2024, we had $5.4 million available, and we made awards to 84 employers. Which equates to the number of identified or planned employees that are part of that training was 958 employees across all the industries and occupations. We did not, in our last year, receive any funds or any applications for our legal cannabis industry-specific funds. Just so you have an idea, an eligible dual training grant applicant is an employer or organization of employers. So we have some grantees that are have been chambers of commerce or specific industry organizations, as well as some nonprofit organizations that have applied representing multiple employers that are smaller employers. There is a matching requirement unless the employer has gross revenue that's below $25 million in the previous calendar year of 25%. And then obviously they have to be, if they're a current dual training grant or previous, they have to be in good standing and meeting all their progress reporting, and et cetera.
Ms. Fitzgibbon, really quickly. So since you received $1 million in each of the fiscal years for cannabis training, and you didn't have anybody take that up, is that in a special revenue or does that cancel back to the general fund? Ms. Fitzgibbon.
Thanks for the question, Chair. In the appropriations language for the legal cannabis funds, there is a sentence that says at the end of fiscal year 25, if the funds aren't used, they can be rolled over into, so they're in like a separate special revenue fund for that and can be rolled over into the special revenue fund and used for any industry at that point. So the funds don't go away. They can still be used for dual training. The other thing that is important to point out is that when those changes were made in 2023, legal cannabis industry was added as one of the industries. So an employer within legal cannabis industry can apply for both of the grants when they're both open, technically. Obviously, we haven't gotten any applicants at this point, but they could technically receive funds or an award from either. So even though those funds don't go away, it doesn't mean they can't ever use them because they can apply for the standard dual training grant that isn't specific to legal cannabis industry as well.
Thank you. I was wondering, Mr. Solomon, did you have something else? Okay, Ms. Fitzgibbon.
So just pointed out that there is two components. There's the related instruction costs that can be covered with grants as well as trainee supports. That was added in the 2023 legislative session, so up to 10% of a grant could be used for that. They cover things like transportation, mileage, lodging in some cases, tutoring services, and sometimes translation or interpreter services. So we have some training programs where the employers are sending their employees away for a week or for 1 week out of a month or a couple of days, and so this covers can be used to cover some of those transportation costs when they have to travel long distance to get to the training that they're seeking out. And finally, I think Dan and I will both agree that this is the program's been around since 2015. This is really an example of a successful interagency collaboration. I was around in 2015 when this program was first enacted, and there was a lot of how are we going to do this? You know, DLI is responsible for this, OHE is responsible for this grant, and I think we've really carved out like really good relationship between the two agencies as to how we work together and how we support each other in our roles to support the grant and also the pipeline program as a whole. Thanks.
Great. Thank you. I was also here in 2015 as the chief author of the bill. So. any member questions on the pipeline project dual training? Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I just quickly glanced at the report, and apologies for not having had a chance to read it until just now. So it's possible I missed something, but from what it looked like to me, in the most recent cycle, there were only grants awarded in, I saw advanced manufacturing, healthcare, IT, and ag. Did I misread that, or is that correct?
Ms. Fitzgibbons.
Chair and Representative, in the most recent round, I have to pull up my report too, I'm fairly confident we had at least one grant in every industry.
Okay.
We often do not have, except for legal cannabis. Yes. We often have very few from the agriculture industry, but this last year we added childcare and transportation, and we had grantees, or we had applicants and grantees from both those industries, which we were really happy about because they were new. So it demonstrated that the fact that there was, we added them and we knew there was a need there that they actually applied for it. But yeah, I'm fairly confident we had a grantees in each one of the industries, but there's definitely low numbers in some of them.
Representative Coulter.
Thank you, and I'm actually glad that I misread that. I will cop to that error, but I guess I'm just curious, you know, advanced manufacturing obviously is a need, but it seems to be a pretty overwhelming percentage of these grants. Is that just a function of that's who is aware of these grants? Is it a function of some programs like you mentioned? I was obviously particularly interested in childcare. And that's obviously a newer addition. So I'm just curious sort of what do you think the reason might be for that?
Ms. Fitzgibbon.
Chair and Representative, advanced manufacturing has dominated, although I would say if we were able to pull out, I don't know if they're in this report, but you can look at previous reports, the share for in the healthcare services has definitely expanded over the last 3-4 years. It's also just where the number of occupations are. So especially the new ones, there's only a couple of them or there's only one of them. So even though that industry might have a number of different occupations, they can only get grants to train in certain ones, whereas manufacturing, advanced manufacturing has a number of them. Healthcare services continues to be expanded. I'd say it's also probably thinking about the types of occupations that lend themselves to be for the dual training model to be useful. And so some industries just don't necessarily have that many occupations where that makes sense to do on-the-job training or where there's a credential that goes along with it. But we DLI spends a lot of time trying to figure out where those occupations are within the industries that we have.
Great. Thank you. Well, I happen to know because I was here presenting a decade ago. Advanced manufacturing were here at the table from the very beginning and really involved, and they have an incredible network. They saw already all four categories, the first four that you mentioned, were there from the very beginning, so ag, healthcare, IT, and advanced manufacturing. But they've kind of been in it from the beginning. All right, so we're going to go over to Representative Duran, and then after that, Cleburne.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you guys for presenting this. And I might have missed it, actually, in the presentation. I'm not sure. But Can you explain to me how legal cannabis industry is a future workforce need for us? Like, why can you explain that to me, please?
Mr. Solomon, or okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. You know, that was added at the request of the legislature in the 2023 session. There was talk at the time with the authors of the cannabis bill around, we had four established industries already, but there was some recognition that some of the occupations that would be coming in cannabis wouldn't fit those four industries. So for example, like the retail side wouldn't have fit one of our four established industries. The labs side wouldn't fit one of our four established industries. And so at the time, the legislature decided to add it as its own industry.
Representative Duran.
I guess, what are you guys doing to help prepare for this? It's obviously in the dual trading pipeline here. What are you guys doing to, I guess, kind of connect the general public or students to this type of industry? What?
Mr. Solomon.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. So we've been, you know, since this was added to our program, we've done our best to meet with interested, you know, stakeholders, folks in the industry or those who are planning to eventually enter the industry, to try to better understand what are the occupations. It is an incredibly diverse industry, you know, from growers to sellers to mint processing to one of the occupations we added this year, specifically based on the input that we heard from potential employers, was around compliance. That there's a lot of interest. So we added a compliance specialist as one of the occupations this year, knowing that, for example, that's a big sort of, you know, thing in the cannabis industry to make sure that you're operating in compliance. And so most of these places have told us they're going to need a point person to be in that occupation. So we're trying to get the word out. I think it is admittedly a really interesting and also challenging time in our state, and that we don't have that many, you know, cannabis-specific education programs yet. And so I think it'll be really exciting to see how that develops and goes forward, to see, you know, what those occupations are. As I like to say, it is in some ways, you know, very, very similar to all the other industries, and in some ways incredibly different.
Representative Duran, do you have anything else?
Yes, Madam Chair. this is actually really concerning to me that we're actually spending tax dollars on this stuff. As far as I know, marijuana is still a Schedule I controlled substance, which doesn't have any therapeutic values of anything, which realistically, when we look at the hemp derivatives, actually, there is some sort of therapeutic value on that aspect of it, but not the actual marijuana, like the psychedelic portion that actually gets you under the influence. So what I'm saying here is that I'm struggling that we spend money on, you know, something that's actually getting people high or putting people under the influence. Now, if we were actually pushing more stuff towards the hemp side of things, which is not intoxicating, I can see us fully being able to get behind something like this, because there seems to be a little bit more therapeutic value on there if you actually look at the data when it comes to it. So it just, one of the things that's really kind of concerning to me is that we're spending money towards this type of, I guess, schooling, you know, or this type of training program. I don't think we do anything for beer or any other products like that, you know, to help people get into that. So this is one of those areas that I struggle with, I guess. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Duran. That was something passed before you got here. And we definitely can have full conversations about that too, and multiple committees, and you are right. So there's a big difference between THC and CBD, which we're not the health committee, so I won't go down that line, but I understand your concerns, and being law enforcement, I'm sure you've seen your share of things, in particular the area that you come from. So I appreciate your concerns. We're going to go to, let's see, Representative. Yep, thank you. Cleaborn. I didn't have it written down, but I knew that's the direction I was going to go. Representative Cleaborn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I've been on this committee, this is my seventh year, and we always talk about advanced manufacturing and we talk about the positions, right? But I never saw, I don't ever recall seeing the number of up to $25 million in revenue. So I'm just wondering, who are these employers who participate in this program? If you can kind of give me an idea of who some of these larger advanced manufacturing folks are.
Ms. Fitzgibbon.
Thanks, Chair and Representative. Well, first I wanted to point out we actually do have grantees that are in the liquor business. We've had at least Bemidji Brewing is one that is comes under advanced manufacturing because they manufacture brew. They brew beer. But there are, I'm fairly confident we have a list of them somewhere in our report, but they're all over the place in terms of the number, the grantees that we have across the state. Many of them do provide a match, even if they aren't required to by the law, if they're small. But some of them don't because they're small. But in the healthcare industry, we've got, you know, all the players that you would think of in the healthcare industry from Sanford Health to CentraCare to Allina to Fairview, all in that area. Advanced manufacturing, Dan knows more than names off the top of my head.
I will just.
Greater Bemidji is one of our organizations that's been around since the first grantee, and they represent a number of employers in the Bemidji area.
Yeah, I will just say, Representative, for advanced manufacturing, it really runs the gambit. You know, we have some companies like Daikin and Faribault, for example, which is a really large, huge international manufacturer of HVAC equipment,
right,
to, some very, smaller manufacturers over the years, like, Intec Plastics and Hastings. So it really runs the gambit from small to pretty big.
Representative Cleaver.
So if you would please be so kind, I'm not really interested in the little guys, right? I don't mind the state assisting the smaller businesses trying to get off the ground. But if we have like major international corporations, I'm just wondering why we're subsidizing their on-the-job training. I don't really have a problem with the program, right? I'm not really questioning the importance of the program. I'm just trying to say, I want to get dollars where they're most needed, right, for the individual or for the smaller employer. So if we could get a list of who some of those bigger people, bigger players, not people, but players are, and then the proportion of this money that they receive, that would be helpful to me. And if you could provide it to the chair and ask the chair to disseminate. Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to go to Representative Allen, then Hansen, then Liebling. Representative Allen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had a question. Are any of the grant dollars going to train up any current inmates within Minnesota prisons by any chance? I just think of the Faribault facility, for instance. They're doing an advanced robotics training there in conjunction with the community college, and I just didn't know if that was somehow connected into that as well.
Ms. Fitzgibbon.
Chair, Representative, they, not that I know of, but the one important part of this is they have to be employed. So I would, if they are employed, they'd have to, like the grantee would maybe have to be the Department of Corrections or Federal Bureau of Prisons or something like that, potentially, if they were employed, but we haven't had any of those ever apply in the past. Yeah.
Representative Allen.
Okay, thank you for that, Madam Chair. Appreciate the answer.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for talking a lot about these cannabis work pipeline grants. Welcome to the legislature, Representative Duran. I'm happy to answer some questions about this and kind of give some background as to how important it is that this legislature make the investments in the cannabis industry. So in 2023, it generated a $4 billion in legal states, and that tax amount total since the beginning of legalization in this country is about $20 billion, which is twice the revenue that we get from alcohol, actually. And we can see that this is adding a lot to our economies. So when we talk about the need to spend to change different policies, or a lot of the bills that have come through this legislature that are asking us to make investments with money we don't quite have, raising revenue matters a whole lot. And this industry is going to do that for Minnesota. And I'm really excited to see how much money it actually does. In terms of the difference between CBD and THC and hemp and cannabis, I just want to make sure that when we talk about these things as public officials, that we're really clear with the public about what the difference is. And so just the difference between hemp and cannabis, they both do contain THC, which can get you high. So to say that hemp is non-intoxicating, I just wanted to correct that. I know it's not the health committee chair, but I wanted to go on record and say that, because hemp is where our current industry right now is extracting their THC from. But that's nationwide, according to the 2018 Farm Bill. And it is a small amount that's in there, but that is where the THC is coming from right now in our current legal market. And then cannabis, obviously, is a plant, same plant, but it has more than 0.3% THC. CBD, we heard about CBD versus THC. Only 14% of Americans actually report using CBD, and it's a far higher number for folks in the who consume cannabis. For example, 1 in 3 women in this country consume cannabis. And so that's important numbers to get on the record. We know that 79% of Americans live in a county with a dispensary. That means that there's somewhere to work and a pipeline of workers that we need to be creating in all of those counties around the nation. So, you know, with cannabis being legal in, it's a 74% of Americans live in a legal state. I think it's important that we just are really clear about the need to create jobs, not just here, but drawing people here to create jobs through programs like this, and then potentially sending Minnesotans out to the rest of the country to impress them with these great skills that they have. So thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. And I will note that marijuana is still federally illegal. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to kind of follow Representative Cleburne's questions about kind of who's getting the grants. And so I assume there is a list of, it says in your materials here that only that there are 84 Minnesota employers. So I assume we could get a list of those 84. And does that, could we get with that, you know, how much each is getting and for what positions? Yep. That would be really helpful. And then it would also be good to know who's giving what match. I also was a little surprised to see this language about the 25% match. And here's a question that I do have, like how does one employer get these funds over another employer? So it gives me a little bit of just concern about competitiveness. You know, we have employers who are all presumably competing against each other sometimes in an industry, and whether we're giving a competitive advantage to somebody who then gets these funds from the state as opposed to some other employer who, you know, maybe they lose their employees to the other place where they can do the training. So could you, if you could speak to that, it'd be great.
Ms. Fitzgibbon.
Chair, Representative, one thing that I was going to point out earlier is just to remind you that the funds, with the exception of the trainee support component of the grants, go to pay for related and recommended tuition and fees and books and supplies. So early on, I used to sometimes talk about this as like a roundabout way to do financial aid. So we could do something similar and just give a scholarship out to students who are in these programs and not worry about the on-the-job training. So it really is just a less direct way to provide financial aid to the individuals who are going to incur. So we don't pay for, if they're in a customized training program that only costs $2,000, the grant pays for $2,000 plus whatever their books and supplies are. So the employer is just the go-between in terms of they're only reimbursed for what they put out. And in that case, the ones that have to do matching, they do the matching. We don't give them the funds until they show us that they've provided the match and paid for the related instruction or the books and supplies that are part of the component. So that's one thing. The grants are a competitive grant. It's a competitive grant process, just like our other competitive grants. There's a set of criteria, some of which is in the statute, that talks about whether it's a robust related instruction program, whether their on-the-job training demonstrates they put that all in their application. There's components about whether the employer has a system set up to recruit, retain, and train diverse employees, including veterans, those with disabilities. There's also a piece about recruiting, training, and retaining recent high school graduates or recent GED recipients. So there's a number of things that are part of that competitive grant review, and then we have a set of lots of reviewers. We're trying to recruit them now. So anybody who you think might be a good reviewer, send them to us because we need them, because we have so many applications. We're expecting way more than we can award. Thankfully, the good part is that thankfully in a number of the years that we have made awards, even though it's lots of, it's a significant amount of money, we have actually been able to award a lot, most of the applicants. So the competition, it's been a competition, we've gone through it, but we've been able to have enough funds to award most of those that have applied. There is also a priority in the application process or in the awarding process for grantees that have a continuing population, so trainees that have been funded in a previous grant round, especially if they're in, a lot of times they are in programs that are more than 1 year. So you think of registered nurse or even an LPN program or some of those that are longer. They are 1 or 2 years, and they get prioritized in the awarding process to ensure that those students can continue in their training, even if, say, the grant isn't awarded for all. So they tell us how many are you're going to do 20 trainees, 10 are continuing, 10 are not, and if they are on the cusp or we don't have enough funds, we will support them for the 10 that are continuing to ensure those trainees get to continue their education.
And Madam Chair, Representative, one other thing I just want to add to Megan's point, the match, I think it's important to note that when we talk about the cash match, unlike some other matching components in other state grants, where you could count like the wage and say that's part of a match or some of those sorts of things, for this particular grant, the match is a straight cash match. It is, you know, you are paying 25% of, the cost of the tuition, the books, the fees, that related instruction. So just something to consider.
Thank you, Mr. Solomon. So I'm getting eyes from the OHE commissioner. I know they're very anxious to come and present the state grant. And I'll let you finish quickly, Representative Liebling, because I know you have something, and then we need to move on so we can talk about state grant, which is a huge hole. So
thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just, and there's more I have to ask about that, but I won't right now. But I just want to make sure we can get that list with that detail. I don't know if you have a report already with all of that detail, but if you don't, I'd love you to supply the committee with that.
Thank you. Thank you so much for being here again, Ms. Fitzgibbon and Mr. Solomon. It's good to see you. And as we are switching over to the next presentation about state grants, I will just say that when the dual training program started, it was a 50% match. So the employer had to put in 50% of the cost of tuition, fees, books. And not sure where along the way, it wasn't myself that dropped it down to 25%, but that's something we could certainly consider as moving it back up. As they said, it's been a very successful program because the industry does pay for half of the training. So half of the education, half of the, you know, again, the tuition to go to Oman State College to get additional training. So they do have skin in the game. When it started, they had more skin. So. And we now have the OHE commissioner and his team up to the table. Welcome to the committee. And we'll be talking about the state grant and a few other things. So, Commissioner, please introduce yourself for the record and start your slide presentation.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Dennis Olson, serve as the commissioner of the Minnesota Office of Higher Education. I won't talk long here because I know the clock is ticking, and frankly, we've been really anxious to get back here to be able to share this information after the deep dive of some of our other legislatively named and competitive grant programs. This is certainly one that we know the committee is deeply interested in. We do have a little bit of background information as well. Certainly won't rush through it, but again, want to make sure that we get to some of the information we do want to share around the budget in particular. But for new members of the committee, it'll be helpful to have a little bit of a background and understanding of how the state grant works. And Chair, I believe to your initial questions early along in the session, how the state grant works and complements North Star Promise and other financial aid programs as well. So with that, I'll turn it over to my colleagues here, and we'll be here to answer questions.
Wonderful. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record, and you can start your slide presentation.
Good afternoon, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Carrie Schneider, and I serve as the research director at the Office of Higher Education. And I am filling in for our very talented financial aid research analyst, Nicole Whalen, who is on leave currently.
Good afternoon, Chair and committee members. My name is Megan Flores, and I serve as the manager of state financial aid programs. So without further ado, we'll go ahead and get started. We're going to start talking first about the state grant program. I know in the past when we were up, we were talking a little bit referring to your budget sheet. This is the big number, so you just look for that one. I think it's line six. But for about the past 60 years, Minnesota has invested in a vibrant economy by recognizing the public good of an educated workforce that is provided in our state through the Minnesota State Grant Program. We are winding down the first year of FAFSA simplification, which has been a very, very long year, and the last year of the current biennium. This slide provides a snapshot of the activity for the Minnesota State Grant Program, as well as the impact the program has had. You'll see the budget appropriation listed. As a reminder, this is a need-based program, and it is available to our residents in the state of Minnesota at both public and private institutions. And it is also something where we have over 75 institutions across the state in participating in the program. We served in the 2024 fiscal year 71,530 students through this program with an average award of about $3,400. Half of the students who receive this award, their family adjusted gross income is less than $40,000. So it does primarily target very needy families. The vast majority of the students receiving the money attend our public systems. And so we have about 60% of the students attending Minnesota State Colleges and Universities at 17% at the University of Minnesota. I myself am a visual learner, so we'll turn the next five or so slides to looking a little bit more at some graphs and charts. This slide provides a demographic information on students who are served by the program. So as you can see, there was a fairly even split in regard to recipients who are white at 48% and those who are Black, Indigenous, and people of color at 47%. However, when we look at gender, we see that there were far more female recipients at 58% versus 37% when we look at male recipients. When we look at the age of the recipients, we see that half of all recipients were ages 20 to 23, followed by 22% of recipients at 24 to 34, and then slightly less, about 21%, ages 19 or younger. And then that smallest category of students receiving the program, or 7%, are those who are ages 35 or older. When we look at where the students attend, half of all state grant recipients enroll in our two-year programs throughout our state, and the vast and very overwhelming majority, or 87%, are at our two-year Minnesota State Community Colleges. When we pivot to the other half of the recipients, they are enrolled at four-year institutions. And when we look at that breakdown, it's very evenly split with about one-third of recipients of our primary need-based state financial aid program enrolled at the University of Minnesota system campuses, our Minnesota nonprofit institutions, and the four-year Minnesota State universities. 80% of our state grant dollars are really geared towards students or going to those four-year degree programs, whereas the last slide focused on where the recipients show up, this slide is a little bit more focused on where the dollars show up. So again, first focusing on the green slide, for the total state grant dollars sent to two-year institution, that was about $50 million, and the bulk of those, or 85%, went to our Minnesota State Community Colleges. When you look at the blue side of the graph for the four-year programs, Whereas the dollars show up for our four-year institutions, we see an even split of 40% or about $76 and $77 million between the University of Minnesota campuses and the Minnesota private nonprofit institutions. And then a smaller percent, 19, or approximately $37 million at our Minnesota State Universities. And the primary difference for this is that the program recognizes the higher costs at both the University of Minnesota campuses as well as the Minnesota private nonprofit institutions in our state. As I mentioned early on, half of the recipients for the state grant program come from families with less than $40,000 adjusted gross incomes. It is also important to kind of look at this, and this graph helps you see where the program touches our families in Minnesota through the lens of family income. So that x-axis, or the horizontal one on the bottom, shows family-adjusted gross income, and then the y-axis on each side shows both the number of recipients as well as the cumulative percent of recipients. And this is essentially a visual representation to show where the volume of students show up, both in low-income families as well as into the middle-class adjusted gross income levels. And it is noteworthy that our state grant program does indeed reach those lower-income families, but it's also a critical part of affordability for moderately income Minnesota students and their families. This chart is really helpful in helping to understand how the state grant works with the federal Pell Grant, which is the primary federal need-based program. Again, on the x-axis, you're going to see those adjusted gross incomes, the same ones we saw on the previous slide. And then on the y-bar chart, that's depicting the average grant. That blue shaded part, that is the part that is the state grant dollars that the students are receiving from the federal Pell Grant. And then the kind of lined part is the state grant. And so as you might expect, as family adjusted gross income increases, that eligibility for the federal Pell Grant, the need program at the federal level, decreases, but our state grant continues to be able to make college affordable for those middle income families. The Minnesota State Grant Program operates on a public policy framework referred to as a design for shared responsibility, which we'll talk a little bit more about in a few slides. But for purpose of this slide, it's helpful to be aware of the central premise of the policy that Minnesota state grants are based on sharing of responsibility, covering that recognized price by the applicant and their family, and when it's necessary, taxpayers, when that ability of the family is either hindered or not present. And we are coordinating our state financial aid program with the federal government's federal Pell Grant program, for which that student's receiving those dollars. And these funds are received by students. They are, therefore, you know, the funds by the students are looked at before we look at the taxpayer kicking in. So we look at the state taxpayer contributing through that lined part, the state grant, and we look at the federal government kicking in on that dark blue part. And so it's really critical to understand that interplay with our relationship to federal government and federal dollars and the catastrophic impact it would have on our students if we were to lose or see a reduction in the support the federal taxpayers give to our students. Uncertainty at the federal level risks the stability of a longstanding partnership, and the current unpredictability of the federal dollars give folks in my line of work a lot of anxiety and gray hair. So shifting here to, we talked a little bit about the program, who it helps, where the dollars go. I want to move towards how eligibility is determined and how awards are calculated. In our state, there are two ways in which Minnesota residents can apply for state financial aid. It's either completion of the FAFSA or the state financial aid application. This is a need-based financial aid program, as I mentioned, so we look at not only the tuition and fees, but we also provide a uniform living and miscellaneous expense allowance, which every student has assigned to them. We set the maximum that we'll consider for the program at the highest priced public 2- and 4-year institution in the state. Students do need to either graduate high school or hold a GED and be at least 17 years old. This is only available to Minnesota residents attending Minnesota institutions. So our state grant is not transportable. It provides an incentive for our residents to stay in our state attending our institutions. It is only for undergraduate students, and the students can't be in default or be in arrears on their child support payments. Students can receive this grant for the equivalent of 12 semesters. And things that we don't look at are their academic record, we don't look at their GPA, we don't consider race, ethnicity, or their gender identity. So when we looked at how the state grant is actually calculated, the design for shared responsibility assumes that students and families have the primary responsibility for paying for post-secondary education in Minnesota. And because of that, the calculation looks at the family income as well as assets and assigning an assigned student responsibility and an assigned family responsibility. We also look at both their past, current, and future ability to pay, the dependency status, and then we take into account the choice of the institution they attend. So that's where in the previous slides where you saw a little bit difference of the dollars and where they went had to do with the price of those institutions. We also take into account their credit level. So if they're taking 3 credits versus 6 credits, 12 credits, and so on. We do cap out our grant program at 15 credits. And then as I mentioned, we take into account the federal Pell Grant amount. And now I'll turn it over to my colleague.
Ms. Schneider.
As part of administering the state grant program, OHE is required per Minnesota statute to project state grant spending at a minimum of twice a year. And we release a public projections report November 1st and November 15th each year. Internally, we run the state grant projections more frequently on an as-needed basis. But to create the required projection, first, we request estimated changes in enrollment and estimated changes in tuition and fees from our higher education partners. We also incorporate wage changes from MMB for state tax filers so that we know how we can get an idea of the expectation for how much wages are going to change. Then we put these assumed changes into a model, and that model runs a full simulation, and it's based on the prior year's state grant applicant data. We also take a close look at FAFSA filing to see how the landscape of student financial need may be changing from year to year, and we compare projected spending to year-to-date cash flow for the program to ultimately settle on the final estimate. Though these projections have historically been accurate within about plus or minus 2%, there are a number of external factors that can impact the accuracy of the projection. So first and foremost is enrollment. If enrollment shifts upward unexpectedly and suddenly, state grant spending will increase. This was particularly noticeable in 2010 and 2011 during the Great Recession. Changes in tuition and fees also have a continuing impact on the projection. If tuition and fees increase more than previously estimated by our higher education partners, this increases spending. And then, of course, changes to the FAFSA formula, which is something that we're experiencing this year, can have a large and unpredictable influence on state grant spending as well. If our projection is off, OHE has a few tools at our disposal to increase or ration awards. In the case of a projected spending balance surplus, OHE may choose to transfer unused funds from the state grant to other programs, or vice versa if a deficit is projected in the state grant. Our office can also increase the living and miscellaneous expense allowance in the second year of the biennium to spend out unspent funds. If funds remain at the end of the biennium, these are returned to the general fund. However, OHE's priority every year is to reward as many eligible students as much money as we can, so we typically don't have any unspent funds to return to the general fund at the end of the biennium. And lastly, we want to note that the state grant does not have a special revenue account like the North Star Promise program does. If the state grant program is projecting a deficit, there is statutory language to reduce awards to cover the deficit. So these options include increasing the assigned student responsibility, or ASR, up from 50% of the cost of college, as well as increasing the assigned family responsibility, or AFR. If all of these options have been exhausted, the office works to determine what other options are available because the program cannot operate on a deficit. So this can include things like not funding summer awards for students. When a deficit is projected, OHE tries to be thoughtful about the impact the reduction in state grant awards will have on all students, because we want to keep students as whole as we can. We also try to communicate as soon as possible with our financial aid partners at our higher education institutions about those changes that may need to be made to the parameters they use to determine the student state grant awards. Historically, deficits have been very rare for the state grant, with a deficit occurring only 4 times over 25 years, but we are experiencing one this year. If the program projects a structural deficit, the office works with the legislature to explore other options for stabilizing the program, such as amending parameters and eligibility in state law or increasing the appropriation. The next slides cover more detailed information about the current state of the program in fiscal year 24 and 25 and projections for fiscal year 26 and 27. So as I mentioned before, one of the factors that impacts state grant spending, which we're seeing right now in fiscal year 24 and 25, was large growth in both the projected enrollment and the number of eligible recipients for the state grant program. So if you look at the chart on the right in this slide, it displays the projected enrollment changes that OHE received from our higher ed partners from the time of the first projection to the most recent projection. So the chart on the left shows fiscal year 24, and if you look at the light blue bar, it represents the first enrollment change estimate our office received in November of 2023 from each of the different sectors. Those estimates typically grew over the course of the year, and in fact, when we look at the data, we see that the number of state grant recipients vastly exceeded anticipated increases in enrollment. That put a large strain on resources for fiscal year 24, which required us to allocate funds from fiscal year 25 to cover the shortfall in fiscal year 24. On the right, it shows estimated changes in projected enrollment for fiscal year 25 that we received from our higher education partners. Again, the light blue bar represents estimates that were first submitted to our office in November of 2023. Those estimates have grown significantly since that time. In November of 23, most institutions were projecting flat or modest enrollment increases. Now they project increases in enrollment of 2 to 7%, as shown by the green bars. And just a side note, even though this slide shows a story of what put the state grant program, partially responsible for putting the state grant program in the situation that it is, we do want to celebrate that enrollment is increasing, because that is good news. We want to see college going rates increase, because we know that increased degree attainment has a positive impact to the state overall.
Thank you. I'm just going to do a quick little interjection. So I just want to remind the committee members, especially since many of you are brand new to the legislature or new to this committee, I don't know if you remember when we had the University of Minnesota system in, and the University of Minnesota system decides how many students they're going to have. Typically, they've had around 60,000 in their system, and they decided to increase their own enrollment to 70,000. So I want you to look at the chart and see that what the University of Minnesota told OHE as what they expected for their student enrollment was considerably less than what they ultimately landed on, and they control their enrollment. They decide how many they're going to have. So unlike the MinState system, it's an open enrollment. So if you apply and you qualify, you most of the time you get in. So if you apply and qualify, you get in. I know the universities may have a little bit more parameters around that, but in a sense, it's an open system, and so they take who they get. And so that is more organic than what the University of Minnesota system did. So I just want to point that out, because they're two very, very different systems, one open, one you have to apply and be accepted in. Representative Cleaborn.
Okay, I'm sorry, I didn't, so the statement that you just made, I'm just trying to clarify. Can you say again how many students the University of Minnesota said they were going to accept?
So what I had said is when we had the University of Minnesota in, they said they typically have had 60,000 students. That's what they've had, and that's about the number that they accept into their system. Uh-huh. And if you look at the chart, it's probably where they landed, what they told OHE, and then they changed their minds, essentially, and they allowed in another 10,000. So when the president was here, she said, we're celebrating our increase in enrollment to 70,000. from a base of 60. So they increased 10, and they have control over who they allow in.
Okay, but a clarifying question. So we do we know if that extra 10,000 is actually why this, I mean, the state grant could have gone up with students who hadn't applied before for state grant and then started applying for state grant. Or, I mean, do we know that it was that additional 10,000 that actually drove this increase?
So, Representative Cleburne, I'm not saying that that drove the entire increase. I'm trying to point to the slide that's right in front of us with the MnState system. And MnState doesn't have control like the University of Minnesota does on their enrollment. And so when you look at these, so they all of the systems have to tell OHE, what do we think we're going to have for enrollment? And this slide is showing you that what they thought they were going to have, it far exceeded the actuals. So this is showing you projections versus actuals. That's what the slide is showing. And what I'm saying is that MnState system is an open system. The University of Minnesota is essentially a closed system. You have to apply, you have to be accepted, you have to, and they control how many they enroll. And they made a decision somewhere in here between when they told OHE, this is how many we anticipate, versus what they actually accepted in. So they went from 60,000 to 70,000. That was the testimony of the president when she was here.
Well, I understand that. Yeah, I understand that the testifier for the University of Minnesota maybe said that they did 10,000 additional students, but we don't know if those were out-of-state students, if they were international students, or if they were Minnesota students. What I'm saying is it's kind of an apple, and I could be totally wrong. I mean, I see that the numbers have gone up 5.7%, but do we know that that's where they came from, out of that 10,000 new students, or is it because people who previously didn't need the state grant now applied for the state grant? We just know, the only thing that we know is it's up 5.7%. Is that correct, or am I mistaken?
Ms. Flores?
Chair, committee members, I believe the question was that did the estimate from the U of M increase by 5.7%? So that chart there for FY24 is showing what originally the university predicted for their enrollment, and then that dark blue bar is showing what actually happened for fiscal year 24. So there was an increase across all institutions, pretty much all public institutions and state grant recipients. I will just note that when a student is admitted, the student's need isn't taken into account. So I don't know that an institution would know if someone is a FAFSA filer when they're admitted, or they're not looking, is this a state grant person or not? So they may not know, you know, where that student is at, and likely wouldn't, that's not a factor taken into account for acceptance for admission. So yes, more students showed up. I think we have here in our next slide that my colleague Carrie is going to speak about, is that Minnesota had a record enrollment growth, higher than the national average, far exceeding the Midwest average. And we were one of the fifth highest states in the entire country to be able to have this kind of enrollment growth, while at the same time having FAFSA growth during a very challenging FAFSA cycle. We had an 11% increase in the number of students filing the FAFSA. So it wasn't just that we had enrollment increases that were not expected in the way that they showed up. So I'll let Carrie speak to this a little bit more. That might help answer some of these questions.
Ms. Schneider.
I don't have anything else to add to that slide, but we can move to the next one.
Sorry, Carrie, I stole your thunder.
No,
yes, go Minnesota, we're awesome. Ready, set, next slide.
All right. So in addition to increases in enrollment, another factor impacting state grant spending in fiscal year 25 was the rollout of the FAFSA Simplification Act. So beginning in fiscal year 25, the FAFSA form, the federal needs analysis formula, and federal Pell Grant award formula changed dramatically from prior years. These changes modified Pell Grant eligibility for many students while also introducing a negative value for the federal needs analysis formula, which is now referred to as the Student Aid Index, or SAI. So our office attempted to estimate how the FAFSA change would impact this year's students, but we did work with limited information that continuously changed throughout the complicated rollout process of the FAFSA Simplification Act. Ultimately, our estimates were off, largely due to a lack of clear and timely information on how to assign an automatic SAI, the student aid index, of negative 1,500. So even though our office started planning for changes to the FAFSA back in 2021, it was impossible to accurately predict the impact of these changes without having the exact formula to calculate student need and SAI so that we couldn't identify who was going to qualify for that negative 1,500, the lowest SAI that you could have.
I'm going to just take a little break here. Representative Robbins, you have a question?
Thank you. Before we move on from that slide, I just wanted to ask, so where did that net out, if you can just tell us, like, how is the automatic 1,500 deducted now? Who qualifies for that piece of the automatic SAI?
Ms. Flores?
Yes, Chair, Representative Robbins. So the negative 1,500 maximum SAI is what replaced the zero expected family contribution. So under the old FAFSA, the very lowest measurement a family could have would be an expected family contribution of zero. Under the new FAFSA, the wording is now student aid index, and it's negative, whereas before it wasn't, and it's negative 1,500. So these are the very lowest income families, and they're actually, in a sense, families who are not only able to contribute towards the cost of their education, but they're not, at the current moment, before even enrolling, meeting their basic needs likely.
Right. I was just looking for, like, I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I was just more looking for, like, is there an income threshold? Oh. Like, what's the cutoff for that?
Madam Chair, Representative, so the federal needs analysis doesn't strictly have an income cutoff. It's fairly complex, but it would typically be a family that is not filing taxes, so a family that earns low enough that they're not required to file federal income taxes. So that's kind of like an earmarker of something that might be more common knowledge for folks. But they don't just look at income. They also look at assets. They look at other factors within that is collected on the FAFSA.
Representative Robbins. Good.
That's okay. Helpful. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Any other questions while we have a little pause here? Not seeing any. Please continue.
All right. The chart on this slide is actual state grant spending for fiscal. Oops, nope. Sorry. Started reading the wrong one. The chart on this slide helps to demonstrate the enormous shift we experienced in demonstrated financial need among state grant recipients. If you look at the bottom left corner of the chart at the gray area to the left of the category labeled zero, you'll see about 30% of students had an expected family contribution EFC of zero or less in fiscal year 24. So again, these are the students with the highest financial aid need. If you compare this to the blue area to the left of the category zero, it shows about 45% of students have student aid index of less than zero in fiscal year 25. And as we mentioned, the majority of these students in this category had an SAI of negative 1,500. So because state grant honors negative SAIs, this change in the FAFSA needs formula is putting a large strain on resources for fiscal year 25. To give you an example of this, if a student who previously had a $0 expected family contribution had received a $500 state grant award, that same student is likely now assigned a negative 1,500 SAI and correspondingly would receive a $2,000 state grant award. So this is a look at actual state grant spending for fiscal year 24 and projected spending for fiscal year 25. This information was provided in the state grant projections report from February 15th. In fiscal year 25, OHE engaged in rationing to offset what was a projected deficit of about $5 million for the program in the November 1st projections report. As it became clear that we would be projecting a deficit for the state grant program, OHE used the options available to us in statute to ration the state grant awards in order to offset the projected deficit. These changes to the state grant award parameters were shared with our higher ed partners and included increasing the assigned student responsibility to 52.7%, increasing the assigned family responsibility to 100%, eliminating summer 2025 state grant awards and implementing an application deadline of November 30th, 2024. The decrease in the average state grant award for students was about $776 if we look at what students were projected receive based on the November projection compared to the February projection. And while fiscal year 25 is not projected to have a deficit based on the most recent projection from the February 15th report, we are frequently monitoring cash flow as we approach the closeout of fiscal year 24. And based on current cash flow, we do not anticipate having unspent funds at the close of fiscal year 25.
Representative Robbins.
I'm sorry, could we run back to the first chart showing the spending versus resources? I just wondered if you could help me understand the timeline. So, because I heard about this in droves from constituents last summer. People had already gotten their financial aid awards, and then they were cut. And people were understandably panicking about what they were going to do. Were they still going to college? Were they going to switch schools, take a year off? Like, it was one of the things I heard the most about for several months from constituents. So, was there a previous, like the November 23 would have led into the 24, which would have been the summer where everyone is upset last year? Like how does the timeline of this roll out because tied to when people get their financial aid awards? And is that something we need to change so that if there is a projected deficit, we're not promising financial aid and then pulling the rug out from under people, because it was very challenging. So if you can just walk me through how the timeline of how the grants are awarded matches with the projections you use to make these decisions.
Ms. Flores.
Chair, Representative, so the timeline, the way that it works is each year in November, the Office of Higher Education issues estimated parameters for the upcoming academic year, so that all schools are using the same parameters when they estimate awards to students and families. After that point in time, there are several things that happen that impact those parameters until we can issue final parameters for the year. One is the legislative session. So during legislative session, things that impact the state grant, such as appropriations or changes to the program, can happen. Also, the boards of both Minnesota State and the U of M set their tuition and fees. And so we are projecting based on what we think the state grant will do, what we think and have heard from our colleagues at the campuses, tuition and fees will be. We're looking out and guessing ahead on those poverty indexes for the living and miscellaneous expense, and we're guessing what Pell will do. Typically for Pell, we just hold it flat, so we assume that the federal Pell grant will remain the same. And so between that time when we estimate in November, session happens and the boards meet, and then we issue final parameters, which we can't do until June when the boards have met. Sometimes it's mid-June or even July because the boards don't meet until after session ends. So that's where it gets challenging, is that we make an estimate in November. The schools use that to make an estimate to some students, both on federal aid, because that's also not determined at that point, as well as on state aid. And then sometimes for institutional aid, it's also estimated, especially if it's a need-based grant, because not always have their tuition rates been set. So there's an estimated award. And then later when the different funding sources, the institution, the state government, and the federal government have finalized the money and the parameters for their program, a finalized award is sent out, typically during the summer before the student enrolls for the fall semester. Does that timeline help? Are there other questions related to that?
Nope, okay. That helps a lot. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Any other questions at this point? We may not get through the whole presentation, unfortunately, today. So as we turn it next week, where we have a new chair, would you, so they may not get through the rest of the presentation in 10 minutes, and it's a really important one. So maybe we could have them back again. I'm sure they'd love to come back again. I just know we're going to need some conversation about this because state grant does connect directly to North Star Promise and how it ebbs and flows. And so we'll let you keep going, but we do only have 10 minutes left or so, and then we'll have to wrap it up. Ms. Schneider, do you want to continue or Ms. Flora? Okay, Ms. Schneider.
So looking ahead to the next biennium, we anticipate increases in state grant spending to continue unless changes are made to the program. State grant awards were rationed dramatically in fiscal year 25 to offset the projected deficit. Oops, I am reading the wrong one again. I am so sorry. Okay, here's a look at spending projections for the next biennium from the February 15th report. In the November 1st projections report, fiscal year 26 was projected to have a deficit of about $91 million. And because of this, OHE issued estimated state grant parameters for fiscal year 26 on December 16th, 2024. The estimated parameters including setting the SAR at 52.7%, increasing the AFR to 100%, and setting an application deadline of July 31st, 2025. Now, in the February 15th projections report, fiscal year 26 is projected to have a $2.5 million surplus. In fiscal year 27, state grant parameters will revert back to parameters in law unless the office decides to ration awards and or changes are made to the program. The February 1st projection based on parameters in law projects a $136 million deficit for the program for fiscal year 2027. And as I mentioned earlier, we're required to publish state grant projections twice per year, but we do typically run projections multiple times per year. That's some of what Megan was talking about once we know those final numbers for tuition and fees, because things do change between when we do the projections and fall, and we try to account for those things through our process of regular projections.
Ms. Schneider, I was just wondering, so if you hadn't done the rationing, what would be the deficit? Both, so we're talking about three different years, I think, at this point, when you get up to 27. Do you happen to know that? It
would be the 91 million.
Yes.
Right. I can answer that, Chair. So thank if you. We had not done those rationing, the rationing brought the program into the 2.5 that you see here for fiscal year 26, it would have been $91 million deficit if we didn't do that rationing.
Ms. Flores, would there have been a deficit in the previous year from that?
So for the previous biennium, for the 24-25 biennium, so fiscal year 24 was where we started to see that enrollment increasing, and we took $12 million from fiscal year 25 and pulled it back to fiscal year 24 to hold families harmless and to not make changes to the awards. The enrollment continued to increase, and then this current year, fiscal year 25, we continued to, was the first year of the FAFSA simplification. So that's where we saw the 11% FAFSA increase on top of, was it 7.4% enrollment increase. And so the enrollment increase and the FAFSA filing increase happened for fiscal year 25 and continued to put pressure on, but we're at the end of the biennium and we had to ration the parameters again because we're not allowed to run a deficit within the program. So we have to adjust the parameters to bring the program into balance.
And Ms. Flores, what would have been the deficit or what would have been, so if you could go into a deficit, what would have been the deficit for 25?
I believe the February 1st, Madam Chair, I believe the February 1st projection based on parameters in law, I have it for fiscal year 27, that was $136 million. For fiscal year 26, would have been $91 million. My brain's not going back to the one previous to that, I'm sorry.
Do you happen to know?
Thank you. So for the academic year 24-25, once we saw that the enrollment continued to increase, we showed a projected deficit of $5 million for the program. And so that's part of why we let our financial aid partners know that we were not going to be able to fund state grants for the summer 2025 term. And why we implemented that deadline was because in November, when we do the projections, that's when we see the fall enrollment data. So we start out the 24-25 aid year, and then the enrollment comes in, and it comes in much, much higher again for the second year in a row. And then we're looking at, okay, we don't have the money to pay out all the grants that we've committed to. We now have to reassess and revise awards.
Thank you.
And so rather than going back and revising awards for currently enrolled students, we chose the option of holding those currently enrolled students for the current aid year harmless. And we shared that we would not be able to fund grants for the summer 2025 term, as well as implementing that deadline of November 30th.
Thank you, Ms. Flores. So as I add up those 3 years, one being 5, one being 91, and then, of course, the 27 being 136, we're at $232 million by my count and some change. That's a pretty big hole. So I just wanted to have a number to start with because I know you've been rationing, and so it's just good for us to know if you hadn't rationed, if you could have just continued with current policy as it was, what would have gone out the door? So 232 by my count, million.
That sounds accurate. Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to be clear, it's not a position we like to be in. We don't like to ration awards for our students. We don't like to put our campus colleagues in these very difficult conversations and situations, nor strain our Minnesota families. However, as you're all aware, we have to spend within the resources. And as Carrie mentioned, increased enrollment is a good thing. I mean, that's what we wanted, was for more Minnesota students to roll at Minnesota colleges, and they are.
Thank you. Please continue.
I believe we have about 5 minutes three left slides then... left for the state grant, so we'll try and just get through those three real quick.
Thank you. Ms. Flores.
So in the interest of time, I don't know that I need to share everything that's on this slide because I think we've covered it pretty well, the situation that we're in. One thing to point out is that for fiscal year 27, the parameters are going to revert back to statute, and so that's why we're seeing the large projected deficit in fiscal year 27. As we start to talk about rationing state grant awards to reduce spending, I thought it would be helpful to demonstrate how this might impact the North Star Promise program, even though Megan hasn't talked about the North Star Promise program, and that'll probably be the next time we're back. But because North Star Promise is a last dollar amount, it's impacted by changes in other aids, such as state grant and Pell Grant, that are applied before the North Star Promise program. So on this slide, you can see an example of what a North Star Promise aid package might look like for a student attending a Minnesota State College. If you look at the chart on the left, it shows a student who's likely receiving a Pell Grant of around $2,700, a state grant of around $1,600, and most likely they don't have institutional aid, so you can see North Star Promise fills in the additional $1,000 to cover the cost of tuition and fees. And because we're able to offer North Star Promise Plus, the student receives an additional award of $400 over tuition and fees. Now, if you look at the chart on the right, it shows how this student's aid from each source would change when the state grant award is reduced due to rationing. The state grant decreases to about $1,000, and the North Star Promise award increases to fill the gap. So we also might see something similar happen if there were changes to the student's federal Pell Grant, as Megan mentioned earlier, such as an increase or decrease in the Pell Grant maximum award. A decrease to a student's Pell Grant would increase their state grant award, and if they're North Star Promise eligible, it may increase their North Star Promise award as well. So just kind of seeing how these three interrelate to each other. And since we're talking about Pell Grants, there is currently a projected $2.7 billion shortfall for the Pell Grant program by the end of the 2025 federal fiscal year. At current appropriation levels, the Pell Grant is projected to have a $71 billion to $111 billion shortfall over the next 10 years. This shortfall is caused by the same factors that are impacting the Minnesota State grant budget, including increased enrollment and the formula changes from the FAFSA Simplification Act. Congress has several options for addressing this shortfall, both immediately and in the next aid. However, without having specifics on how Congress would address the shortfall, we can't model the exact cost or the impact on Minnesota's financial aid programs, but we do know reductions in the size of a student's Pell Grant or elimination of the Pell Grant total would increase state grant spending. And we know reductions in the size of the Pell Grant would likely increase demand on the North Star Promise program for students who are eligible for that program.
Madam Chair.
Commissioner.
Thank you. Maybe I can bring us home here within the next 30 seconds, something to contemplate as we think about returning to finish up the discussion here, but wanted to just briefly preview for the committee the governor's budget recommendation here to, you know, hopefully address one, the shortfall, but two, eliminate the need to further ration awards. And so I won't read everything on the slide, just in the interest of time, but and also recognizing this isn't a budget bill hearing, but just, you know, something to think about here. Hopefully we have an opportunity to work together, continue talking about in the future. But essentially, other than a small agency operating budget adjustment, this is the only other general fund recommendation in the governor's budget. And it is $7.5 million a year, so $15 million over the biennium. That investment, coupled with all of the parameter changes that you see on the slide here, and again, with the interest of time, won't read through them, but we'll be able to address, again, without having to further ration awards. So it's adjusting all of the parameters. And I will just note for the committee, we did present this in late January to the Senate, and have since heard some concerns from a few members of the Senate committee, as well as others interested, that, you know, some of the proposals primarily related to the differentials in the AFR, the independence with dependents, so our student parents primarily, you know, maybe a sticking point. And so hopefully an opportunity here to work together to look at some other options. But frankly, as you've heard from the presentation, we are essentially, you know, out of options without continuing to pull other levers of parameters. And so appreciate your consideration here and look forward to more discussion during the actual budget bill introduction.
Thank you, Commissioner. We will have you back. And whether it's when I have the gavel or when Chair Wogelman has the gavel, we'll definitely have you back so we can talk more about state grant and how that works with North Star Promise and North Star Promise Plus. And with that, members, we are adjourned and we're going to go to session.